Hello, everyone. My name is Matthew Bush. I'm a research fellow at the Lowy Institute in the East Asia program. I'd like to welcome you all to our event this evening on the forthcoming Lowy Institute paper from Andrew Rosser called Beyond Access, Making Indonesia's Education Sector Work. First, I'd like to recognize the traditional landowners on whose land we meet tonight and pay respects to their elders past and present. I would also like to thank our partner, the Victorian Department of Premier and Cabinet, who sponsors this event and sponsors my program, which focuses on Southeast Asia. And so I'd like to thank them for their support. I'd also like to thank both of our panelists, who I'll now introduce. Immediately to my right is Andrew Rosser, who's a professor of Southeast Asian Studies at the University of Melbourne's Asia Institute. His research focuses on Indonesia's economic liberalization during the New Order and since the 1997-1998 economic crisis and subsequent democratization. From 2012 till 2015, he was an Australia Research Council Future Fellow, and he's carried out work for the World Bank, AusAid, DFAT, DFID, OECD, and Oxfam, among others. He has a PhD from Murdoch University, and his book, The Political Economy of Economic Liberalization in Indonesia, State, Market, and Power, was published by Routledge in 2002. To Andrew's right is Dr. Ken Setiawan. She is a Mackenzie Research Fellow at the University of Melbourne's Asia Institute. She's also an associate at CILIS, which is the Center for Indonesian Law, Islam, and Society at Melbourne Law School. Her work focuses on contemporary Indonesian politics and society, and with a special focus on past human rights violations. She has a PhD in law from Leiden University, and her book, Promoting Human Rights, National Human Rights Commissions in Indonesia and Malaysia, was published by Leiden University Press in 2013. With that all out of the way, I'd like to sort of draw you, Andrew, because there are only a few of us that have read your paper, and so I'd like to just sort of draw you a bit to tell us a bit about your paper and a bit about the sort of argument that you advance in it. And specifically, I think a good place to start is the title, so Beyond Access. What exactly do you mean by Beyond Access?
All right. Thanks, Matt. I gather the paper is due to be published in the next couple of weeks.
The paper
right?
will
fingers,
be out.
Fingers, yes. fingers crossed.
The paper so will be out at end of November. And I will make sure that everyone who is registered will be notified when the paper comes out.
Good. Look, the title, Beyond Access, it relates to the fact that Indonesia has had considerable success in improving participation in the education system at all levels, but particularly at the basic education level. And in that respect, Indonesia is similar to many other developing countries. Developing countries in general have been reasonably successful in getting kids into school. The big challenge for Indonesia, and again, the country is like many other developing countries in this respect, is to improve the quality of education. Historically, the focus of the Indonesian government and the international community in relation to Indonesia's education system has been to improve enrollment levels, but increasingly now things are turning to matters of quality. Without, so far, it has to be said, much sign of success. If you look at Indonesia's performance in international standardized tests such as PISA, TIMSS, and PIRLS, the country doesn't seem to have made a great deal of progress. It started participating in these tests in the late 1990s, but its results have failed to improve significantly over time. And Indonesia continues to be ranked towards the bottom of countries that participate in those tests. And in particular, behind other countries, other developing countries within its immediate region, such as Vietnam Malaysia and Thailand.
And so how do you explain that? How do you explain the progress on getting kids into school, but the lack of progress on sort of improving educational outcomes once they're there?
Well, look, I think there are a number of different elements here. I mean, at one level, getting kids into school is something that is relatively easy to do compared with improving the quality of an education system. You know, getting kids into school means, you know, just producing a, or generating a bit of extra funding, building a school system, recruiting teachers. A lot of it can be supply driven. It doesn't really require great change on the part of the people who are part of the education system. In fact, people are generally happy if education is made more widely available. Teachers like it because there are more jobs to go around. Teachers' unions like it because, for precisely the same reason. Parents and children like it because there's an opportunity to get an education. But tackling the thorny issue of quality is much, much harder in political terms because it does require some real changes in behaviour. It requires teachers to turn up to work and not to bunk off and you know, go and take a second job doing something else. It requires teachers to actually educate students as opposed to just looking after them and keeping them off the streets for, you know, a few hours every day. And in that sense, you know, it's a lot more difficult politically. It runs up against the interests of teachers' unions and in some cases education bureaucrats as well, who don't really want to be held accountable for the academic performance of the school or university systems that they oversee. So I think at the core of the issue is the different politics around access and quality.
Mm. And so, Ken, I might ask you to come in at this point, because someone who studies civil society and social issues, why do you think this isn't a bigger social issue, or is it a big social issue in Indonesia?
Well, I think thanks, Matt. I think at this point, as I've also read Andrew's paper, it's basically that this push from civil society seems to be lacking, and I'd like to hear Andrew's comments on that. When quality lags so far behind the access to education, then why aren't parents, or why isn't there a kind of a protest, big demonstration? Why aren't they resisting more? So the broader question here is also what the role of civil society is. What civil society can do, what capacity is there also within society to enhance the quality outcomes of education, how can parents, for instance, have a say in the management of schools if that would contribute to quality outcomes. So probably I'll go over to Andrew now.
All right, look, I think this is a crucial issue. I mean, people that I've spoken to who are interested in and understand the politics of education in Indonesia often point to the fact that there is not a great deal of civil society mobilisation around issues to do with education quality. There is civil society mobilisation around some other education-related issues, but not so much education quality. In general, parent groups, for instance, in Indonesia are actually just not terribly well organised. You know, they don't. There are some groups in some relatively affluent suburbs in major cities who have organised in relation to issues going on at their local school. But more widely than that, they haven't organised. They're not a great force for lobbying the government to demand a better quality education system. So part of the issue here is to do with organisation by parent groups. If you look at NGOs, you know, there have been a number of NGOs that have been very active in relation to education issues in Indonesia. YLBHI, the Indonesian Legal Aid Foundation, is one of them. Indonesia Corruption Watch, another one that's been very actively involved. Their concern is not so much education quality. I mean, I think they would like to see Indonesia develop a better quality education system, but by and large, their mobilisations have centred much more on questions of access, and typically in response to moves by the Indonesian government to introduce market-oriented reforms in the education system that would make it harder for poor people to access the education system, and in particular, parts of it targeted for improvements in quality. And there have been a number of reforms tried over the past decade or so of that nature, and the NGOs have employed a number of different strategies for trying to oppose those reforms. The third sort of key group that I think are really important in and in fact absolutely crucial in this whole in this respect is the business community. A guy called Stephen Kosak, a political scientist based at Harvard University, wrote a very interesting book a few years ago looking at the politics of mass education in Ghana, Taiwan and Brazil. And he developed in that book an argument about the conditions under which governments in developing countries introduce policies of mass education, and along with that, improvements to the quality of education. And in pointing to the Taiwan case, he sort of said, look, you know, the business community can be a really, really crucial force for change, and in particular, an upskilling of the education system, a widening of access, but also an improvement in the quality of the education system, if it's in their interest to have access to greater supplies of skilled labour. And he points to a particular moment in Taiwan's history where the business community was trying to move out of low-wage, labour-intensive, unskilled manufacturing activities into higher value-added sort of manufacturing activities, and needed a more skilled labour force to go to help them make that transition. Now, in Indonesia, you don't have the same sort of dynamic at work at all, and it seems to me that this is actually a really crucial obstacle to improving the quality of the education system. There have been some signs recently of the business community making a case, a public case, for Indonesia to develop a better quality education system. In 2012, the consulting group McKinsey and Company published a report on the Indonesian economy, part of which focused on the education system, and that you know, it argued that if Indonesia was to become more competitive in future, it would need to improve the quality of its education system so that the sort of skilled labour that an advancing economy needs would be available. But instances like that really are fairly rare. By and large, the business community has focused much more on, you know, trying to win government contracts, trying to reduce the minimum wage and things like that, rather than improvements to the education system.
And I mean, does that tell us something about sort of, because in Indonesia there's this close relationship between business and politics, and indeed, you know, many politicians are businessmen themselves. Does that tell us something about the sort of commercial sort of realities of politics in Indonesia, especially, or as I think you would argue in the paper, this is a sort of durable feature that prevailed before democratization and has sort of continued after democratization.
Look, I think that's right. I mean, if you look at the you know, the sources of the competitiveness of Indonesia's capitalist elites, you know, they just don't include a command of technology and ability to innovate. You know, their competitiveness is based much more on control over natural resources, access to government contracts through privileged access that stem from good political connections and so on. So the game for them is really quite, you know, is really quite different to the sorts of Taiwanese entrepreneurs that Kosak writes about in that particular moment in time when Taiwan was going through an industrial upgrading process.
What about sort of the other things that schools do, right? Because schools don't just sort of like provide education, as you said, they keep people off the street. They also sort of engage in nation building. They sort of teach people and socialize people to becoming citizens. They, in the case of Indonesia, help spread the sort of national language. So I'd be interested to sort of hear both of your views on the sort of relevance of that, because I think it's quite different than the way that we think about school, for example, in a developed country like Australia.
Yeah, I mean, in the paper, I mean, really, the, you know, if I was to boil the argument of the paper down to one or two sort of key points, it's that you know, in Indonesia's schooling system has not, and more generally its education system, in a way has not been fundamentally about promoting learning. And in that sense, it hasn't necessarily been about education fundamentally. It's been about trying to achieve a whole lot of other objectives that are reflective of the broader political economy in which it is located and the history of the history of the country. I mean, I have a line towards the back of the paper where I talk about, you know, Indonesia's education system being run by elites that are concerned to use the education system to accumulate resources, distribute patronage, mobilise political support and exercise political control. So whilst, you know, ostensibly the education system is meant to be about, you know, promoting learning and achieving educational objectives, and that it certainly is a dimension or a driver of what happens in the education system, there have been these other agendas at work at the same time that have served to undermine that educational imperative. You know, you need to remember here that much of Indonesia's education system was built during the New Order years, and in particular during the late 70s and early 80s, when the government was awash with oil money and had the resources at last to dramatically expand the education system out into the more far-flung parts of the country, to recruit large numbers of teachers. And between the mid-70s and the mid-80s, roughly a million teachers were recruited. The teaching labour force doubled in size in that period of time. And so, in that sense, you know, the much of the education system was built at that particular moment in time. And the New Order, in doing so, had a number of competing objectives at work. I mean, you know, it wanted to, you know, at least rhetorically, it said, you know, it wanted to provide a mechanism through which Indonesians could develop the skills they needed in order to service the New Order's economic development ambitions. But it was also looking to kind of expand the bureaucratic franchise that Suharto had developed, the key element of which was, you know, the selling of public service positions in exchange for the opportunity to exploit them for rent-seeking purposes. So you know, the expansion of the education system, I mean, also became about roping in elites and communities in across the country into the New Order and kind of gaining their loyalty and support through that. And, you know, nation building has been another sort of, I think, was another dynamic that was at work during New Order times. The education system has been a key mechanism for promotion of the use of the national language, a commitment to national identity. Schools and universities have often been the sites of all sorts of nationalist rituals, flag raising ceremonies, Independence Day ceremonies, and so on. So they've been a key locus for trying to promote nation building, as well as, you know, allegiance to the state.
Probably, if I can add a little to that, I think Andrew's absolutely right when he says that the education sector in Indonesia, particularly under New Order, was not concerned with really the learning and providing a high quality education. It had to do with larger objectives that suited the regime in power, and the schooling system was very much a central of the political indoctrination that the New Order engaged in. And that, I think, depletes, if you will, the capacity of the system in itself to focus on quality. Actually, the baseline then, or the starting point, is actually quite low. The other thing is that if we maybe go back in history a little bit further, one of the things that Andrew's paper reminded me also of, and almost a selective, the selective focus on quality reminded me very much also in the way how in colonial times the education in then the Dutch East Indies was organized. And I think that historical perspective is also really important when we talk about long-term effects of quality of education.
Mm. And I mean, the question that leaps to mind from both of your answers is then, if that was the sort of imperative during the New Order, well, in democratic Indonesia, how do sort of demands change for the school system as nationalism and religious identity maybe become sort of, if not more effective, at least more attractive political tools to democratic politicians?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think those sorts of trends have had an impact. I mean, I think what they have served to do is reinforce an orientation within the education system away from a focus on basic skills, the sorts of things that get tested through PISA, TIMS and PIRLS, and more towards sort of value-based education. I mean, it seems to me that even in the state education system in Indonesia, there is a very, very strong emphasis on values, and they almost dominate to some extent over the concern to develop basic skills. And you can see this sort of dynamic at work in the changes that were made to the school curriculum in 2013, where things like education and I think some sort of science and math-based elements of the curriculum were removed in order to make space for character education. I mean, a lot of that was driven by concerns about violence in Indonesia's school system, because violence is a real problem in the school system. You know, it's students beating each other up, beating up teachers beating up students. I mean, everything goes on, sexual harassment, that sort of thing. And the Indonesian government's response at the national level was to make character education a compulsory element of the curriculum. I might hand over to Ken, I suppose, at this point.
Well, that actually reminds me of more recent pushes from the government to educate people on Pancasila, so the Indonesian state ideology, and really to make that a defining element, if you will, of not just the education sector itself, but society as a whole. That's not to say that there is no place for value-based education, because that's not the point. But if it comes to the detriment of other, I would say, very basic skills, because, Andrew, in your paper, you mentioned, I don't have the figures here ready, but the figures of how low the abilities of 15-year-old children in terms of maths and reading comprehension. And I think that is a genuine concern, particularly if Indonesia wants to move away from a reliance on low-skilled and low-paid wage jobs and being reliant on natural resources. So
what sort of domestic constituency exists for that, for those changes, for sort of those improvements?
Well, I'm not sure there is one. If you look at the elements that have been pushing an education reform agenda in Indonesia, and it's been a particular type of reform agenda. It's been one that has seen the answer to Indonesia's problems with education quality as lying in increased corporatization of public educational institutions, both universities and schools, greater capacity to charge fees, and moves along those sorts of lines. It's been technocratic elements within the Indonesian government. It's been figures like Budiono, certain figures in the education ministry, and key elements of the donor community. The World Bank in particular has been very, very important in pushing this sort of reform agenda, I mean, to the point where it's funded projects or activities where one of the key conditions has been the production of new laws providing for these sorts of reforms. But if you look at the look more widely, there just hasn't been a strong political constituency for education quality. I mean, my hopes, I think, pin actually largely on the business community, that there will be some shift over time in the position of the business community, that they will start to advocate more consistently for improvements to the country's education system. And especially as industries like those that are referred to in the Indonesian context as the creative industries become increasingly important to the economy, because they're different to the natural resource sectors in as much as they rely on a degree of skilled labour, a capacity to innovate, to design, and so on. You know, they're industries that require skilled labour and therefore an effective education system.
And is a sort of priority of the president. So the President Jokowi has sort of talked about how he wants 1,000 startups and he wants to sort of be friendly to this innovation culture, and many of these new sort of innovative e-commerce companies are owned as well by sort of powerful Indonesian groups. So you would sort of think that there's a possibility to move forward there. Ken, I want to ask you about rights, because sometimes, and this is talked about in Andrew's paper, rights are invoked actually to challenge some of the technocratic or corporatist or market-driven attempts to introduce quality. And they come from sort of progressive groups like NGOs that we would look at and say, oh, you know, that they're very progressive. But they see this as a sort of violation of a universal right to education if it results in some people sort of paying more or missing out, or there being different gradations of education. So to talk a bit about sort of rights and sort of what it means when people talk about universal rights in Indonesia, and how sort of different civil society groups see that.
Well, I think NGOs in Indonesia very much focus on the concept of rights in criticizing reform. I don't think that they are opposed to reform in itself. Mm. That's not the point. But it's about the quality of reform and whether that is consistent with the objectives of the liberal values, if you will, that these groups stand for. So if I could give an example from my research, so this is moving a little bit away from the education sector, but Andrew can expand on that in a minute, I think. One of the things that NGOs in Indonesia have criticized, and this is a while ago now, was the establishment of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Indonesia, taking this law to establish this body firmly grounded on, you know, in line with international law objectives and principles, taking that to the Constitutional Court. It wasn't because that they opposed the idea of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in itself, but it was concerned with a number of provisions which could very lead to the impunity of perpetrators, which would basically shield, would not do justice to the victims and survivors of this kind of violence, and those are the people that these reforms need to serve. But what then happened was that the Constitutional Court cancels the law in its entirety, which was also not exactly what they wanted. But again, I think the point is not so much that they are opposing these reforms, these liberal reforms, but it's about the exact content of it and whether that actually leads to what they see, the fulfillment of rights. And there is, I think Andrew could come with a similar example from the specific education sector.
Yeah, look, I mean, what I've seen is NGOs in particular, the sorts of organisations that I mentioned before, the Indonesian Legal Aid Foundation and Indonesia Corruption Watch, invoke rights as a way of challenging the neoliberal reforms promoted by technocrats and donors, which were aimed at trying to promote improvements in education quality through a particular mechanism, through a particular approach, a kind of, you know, market-based approach that assumes that the corporatization of educational entities is a good thing, the ability to charge fees is a good thing, and so on. And they've invoked rights in part because one of the key institutional mechanisms they have been able to use for challenging these reforms. And they've challenged them essentially on ideological grounds. They have a different vision of what Indonesia's education system should be about, what it should look like. They're concerned about having a marketized education system. They'd like a better publicly funded education system that offers the same level of educational quality, hopefully a high level of education quality to all Indonesian citizens. But they've one of the institutional mechanisms available to them in order to challenge that sort of market-based reform agenda has been to challenge laws or government regulations through the Constitutional Court or through the Supreme Court, through processes of judicial review, where the basic purpose of the legal challenge is to demonstrate that there is an inconsistency between the policy or the law that is being challenged and some higher level law or in the case of the Constitutional Court, the Constitution. And, you know, the Indonesian Constitution and many Indonesian laws provide for various rights related to education. So the legal resources that the NGOs have needed have been there in law for them to invoke education rights and to do so in particular in a way that has enabled them to challenge the market-based reforms. And by and large, they've done so very, very successfully. The NGOs have been able to knock over a whole bunch of government policies of a market-oriented nature.
Mm. I think there's parallels sort of across Indonesia. So I look a lot at investment or more economic issues. Infrastructure is a great example. There's been a very long-standing suspicion of any sort of for-profit infrastructure that isn't sort of open to all, whether it's roads or electricity even. And so as a consequence, after the financial crisis, when neoliberal reforms were introduced, they almost never sort of did what they were expected to do, and there was a sort of real coalition of sort of groups that came out from all different parts of society to oppose these things. And I think it's clearly historically rooted, I would say, but to change the frame of reference a little bit, what does this mean though for profit providers that are interested in this market? So what does it mean for an Australian university or an Australian senior secondary school that's looking at Indonesia and saying there's a lot of people and there's clearly sort of gaps in skills and a need for higher quality education, but how do you sort of go about exploiting that opportunity, or is there an opportunity?
Well, I guess, I guess the thing here is that I'll focus on universities because I understand that sector better than the school sector. But I think what it means is that any foreign university looking to set up in Indonesia is going to face not just a sort of market-based challenge, that is, making their product attractive to the country, to potential customers. They're also going to face a political challenge because there is I think quite a lot of anxiety in Indonesia about foreign universities setting up and the consequences that will have for domestic universities. So you get, what I'm seeing is some opposition to, quite a lot of opposition to the prospect of Indonesia opening up to foreign universities, because that is on the cards. I mean, it is something that's being actively debated and discussed in Indonesia, and a legislative framework is already in place to make that possible. I'm seeing quite a bit of opposition from within the education sector itself, and in particular from the major state and some sectors of the private university system. And basically the concern there is that if foreign universities come in, they'll clean up, and the major state universities will be knocked off their pedestal. The private universities will lose their students and be put out of business. At the same time, though, you do have other groups that are also concerned about the prospect of foreign universities coming into Indonesia. It's not just actors within the education system itself. It's also the NGOs that we were talking about before. And for them, the concern is not so much a rights-based one this time. It's reflective of the sort of radical populist tradition of thinking that has permeated the NGO community in Indonesia over many decades, and which is, you know, centres on the idea that, you know, Indonesia is a poor developing country that is often subject to exploitation by powerful international actors, and they see foreign universities coming in as to being just, you know, yet another manifestation of Indonesia's subordination in the global system, another sign of foreign economic domination. Student groups as well, university student groups, you know, who can mobilise. You know, they can mobilise in quite significant numbers to hold protest, to take matters to court and so on. Ideologically, they're opposed to this as well. So there's actually quite an extensive, I think, political constituency that is opposed to the entry of foreign universities. The business community seems to be fairly silent on this, so you're not hearing a whole lot on this issue out of them. So, you know, on balance at the moment, the cards really seem to be against foreign universities coming in, notwithstanding the fact that there is this, I think, broad recognition that Indonesia's education system more generally, but its higher education system in particular, is increasingly not fit for purpose. Improvements are needed, and foreign universities might be the only way, at least in the short term, that the country is going to achieve significant improvements.
Do you want to?
Well, I think what Andrew outlines here is consistent with what I would say is heightened nationalist discourses in Indonesian politics. The Jokowi presidency, I think, so far can be characterized as really promoting that nationalist discourse. In part, that is, you know, we can explain that because of the trajectory of the political campaign, his political rival in the presidential elections. But, you know, he has really been critical of Indonesia's reliance on the West. He's been calling for Indonesia to be politically sovereign, to be economically self-reliant, with a very strong Indonesian cultural identity. We see this also played out in a number of cultural policies. So I think taking that together, I think it's almost a very bleak picture for foreign universities that try to get into the Indonesian education sector.
Would you agree, though, that this is an issue that Australia should still sort of exercise itself with, because it has an interest? It has an interest in sort of whether it's producing students that can come to Australian universities, or just sort of making sure that the doing its part to help the Indonesian economy continue to sort of prosper and grow. Does Australia have an interest in sort of focusing on this issue, though?
Oh, I think Australia probably does have a fairly significant interest in how this plays out. I think from Australia's point of view, it would like to see the Indonesian higher education system opened up, some foreign providers come in, education standards improve, quality improve, not least because that would mean that Indonesian students coming into the Australian university system would be of a better quality than they currently are. They might have better English language skills, because that is a barrier at present to increased Indonesian student enrolments in the Australian university system. If foreign universities could set up in Indonesia, there'd be a good number of Australian universities that would think very, very seriously about doing precisely that. So I think Australia's clearly got an interest in this, of a fairly sort of utilitarian economic nature. The Australian government, through this sort of current trade agreement process that's going on with Indonesia, would seem to be pushing for some sort of progress in that respect. Whether that's likely to be effective at the end of the day is another matter, though. My clear sense is the Indonesian government is trying to stall on this issue because it it's behaving in a sort of, you know, protectionist, nationalist way that we're seeing play out in numerous other sectors. It's recognizes that there's a lot of domestic opposition to opening up the higher education system, and it, I think, perhaps looking longer term, it prefers a scenario where at least the very top Indonesian universities are able to compete in their own right globally. And there are a whole lot of things that the education ministry and the research, technology, and higher education ministry are doing to try and position the UWIs and the UGMs and so on to be more competitive.
Mm. Mm.
It's slow going, though.
Right, right. I might open it up for questions from the audience at this point. So if you have a question, please just raise your hand and wait for a microphone to get to you, and then identify yourself, and I might take two questions at a time if that's all right, but I see there's one in the back there.
Thank you. My name is Yasinta Kurniasi from Indonesian Studies at Monash University. I have first one is comment, and the second one is questions for Andrew. The first one is comment. 3-4 days ago, I was watching Jokowi's speech. Very interesting. In that occasion, he addresses several points. The first one, the general, I realize really the educations, but that's in relation to the rise of middle class in Indonesia and the need for vocational training, educations. He was also very strong in expressing his concern about the quality and the quantity of publications by university lecturers. He actually said, after this I'll go back and find it for you if you're interested in that speech, he said, I think we should probably invite foreign university to open in Indonesia because of that, because of the lack of research publications for the international audience. So I'm not sure whether he wrote that speech for that occasions, but it's very interesting. Very, very recent, 3-4 days ago. The second one is questions for Master Andrew. The business with international school. So it's been happening for a long time, I think. At one time, every school set up what they called school plus, or I don't remember the exact name, and then National becoming plus. Becoming a money making machine. Can you comment on that? I have recently studied ethnography studies because my own research led me to that, and there might be a potential of some sort of movement in terms of improving quality. So in Jakarta, there are maybe still a small amount of kind of international school. The focus is critical thinking. Thank you.
Just one other question, perhaps. This gentleman right in front of you, Andrea.
Hi, my name is Ezra Prabojati. I'm from Monash University. I have two questions for Ken. You mentioned about the NGOs, about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So do you think that Indonesia needs to be more serious dealing with the human rights issue, particularly about the 1965 strategy of PKI, the communist, where recently the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency declassified all of the documents related with the coup d'etat? What is your view about this? And this brings me to Andrew. So Andrew, in regards to this, is human rights a big issue in Indonesian education system? Should the government or the superstructure, political inside, focus on acknowledging this long problematic issue or focus on the recent issue, which is the economy? Thank you.
All right. How do you want to divide it up?
Yeah, okay. Look, Jacinta, thanks for referring me to that You're drawing my attention to that speech. I haven't had a look at it, but I'll try and find it on the internet and see exactly what Jokowi had to say. The Indonesian government, the education related ministries have been putting a lot of pressure on Indonesian academics to publish in international journals, using Scopus in particular as their preferred way of identifying the sorts of journals that Indonesian academics are meant to publish in. Because certainly back in the mid-1990s, the output from Indonesian universities in Scopus index journals was very, very low. Since this policy has come in, or this push has come in, Indonesia's production of Scopus index articles has gone through the roof. I mean, it's increased quite significantly. And it's actually reflective of a trend across most higher education systems. Actually, there's been a huge increase in output across higher education systems throughout the world. But Indonesia has responded. The big issue is, as I see it, is, I mean, you know, certainly the overall output is still fairly low, but the big issue is that the output, such as it is in the if you like, the dodgiest journals that happen to be indexed in Scopus. You know, the typical model is that an Indonesian university will run a conference. It will take the papers from that conference, do some peer reviewing of them, send them off to a journal that happens to be indexed in Scopus, but which basically operates a bit like a vanity press, frankly. I mean, so long as the conference organisations have done an initial peer review, they will publish the papers. So the papers that are getting produced are ones that are in fairly low grade sorts of outlets. And so the key challenge for Indonesia on that front is to try and improve the quality of the outlets that Indonesian academics are publishing in. And Jokowi's comment, as you've presented it, I mean, may well be simply a threat. You know, basically, unless you guys lift your game, well, we're going to have no option but to allow foreign universities in. I mean, that's the way I read his comment. But you know, that's without having read the article. On international schools, and it's international standard schools, actually. I mean, international schools are things like, you know, the schools where expats send their kids in Indonesia. But the education ministry did introduce a policy on international standard schools in around 2007, 2008, which basically identified a small group of public schools, by and large public schools. Private schools could participate in the scheme as well, but it was really focused very much on public schools. And the idea was that at least one school in every district would be designated as international standard. And those schools that were designated as such were allowed to operate in quite a different way to other public schools. They were given the permission to charge fees in contravention of the government's policies on free basic education and the constitutional provisions related to that as well. They were meant to use international curricula. They were allowed to employ foreign teachers. They were given additional resources, quite significant additional resources by the government to purchase, top-notch IT facilities, install air conditioning systems, and all sorts of things. This was one of the sort of marketising reforms, because this the idea for this came up. I mean, it's been around for a long time in Indonesia, but it got a real push at the time of the Asian financial crisis, when the World Bank got together with some sort of technocratic people in the education ministry and people in Bappenas and produced a series of reports outlining a reform agenda for Indonesia's education system, and this was one of the ideas that came up. But this was one of the reforms, the marketising reforms, that got knocked over by the NGOs by using the Constitutional Court, and it was an Indonesia Corruption Watch led piece of litigation that led to the killing of the relevant provision in the 2003 education law and a law on a national education system that provided the legislative foundation for that particular policy. Look, just I've given very long answers to those two comments or questions. So, Israel, just very quickly, you know, is human rights a big issue in Indonesia's education system? I think, you know, if you look at things like enrollment rates. And you know, usually the right to education is understood in terms of kids being able to go to school. And so if your focus is on things like, you know, kids actually being in school, Indonesia's done extraordinarily well in that respect. And in that sense, the right to education is not a big issue. If you have that sort of minimalist understanding of what fulfilment of the right to education means. But if the right to education is about actually learning something while you're at school, then it's a massive issue for Indonesia. The other thing I would say is that, you know, rights have been invoked by these NGOs in trying to kill off these marketizing reforms because, you know, by going to the Constitutional Court or by going to the Supreme Court and lodging a judicial review request, they have had to draw on elements in legislation that they can used to build a case against the reforms, and they very often refer to the right to education in that respect.
Very quickly, maybe on 65, because yes. we're running low on time.
I'll be very quick.
Thank you.
Thanks, Isra, for your question. Does Indonesia need to be more serious with addressing past human rights violations, including the 1965 case? I think the answer is just yes. Addressing past human rights violations, I think that is really part of the larger question of democratization. And the 1965 violence in that sense is also really important because the violence in effect proved to be the fundament of the new order state and actually also informed very much the political indoctrination through schools that I previously talked about. Mm. I also think that this is not just a question of, you know, you mentioned the declassified documents from the United States. It's not just because there are these documents out of the United States. Indonesian civil society organizations, but also the National Human Rights Commission, have actually consistently asked for these cases to be addressed. And most of their recommendations have not been heard. And that really reveals a bigger problem in terms of human rights reform and legal reform in Indonesia, and by extent, the quality of democratization. Is that fast enough?
That was very good. I suspect we may be talking about this in 5 more years, though.
Yeah.
Still. Anyways, thank you very much, Ken, and thank you very much, Andrew. It's been a pleasure to sit here with you and to discuss the paper and discuss other proximate issues to the paper. So I would like now to invite Matt Lowe, who's the Executive Director of International Engagement in the Department of Premier and Cabinet, up to the lectern for a vote of thanks.
Good evening, everyone. So I'm Matt Lowe, another Matt, the Executive Director responsible for international engagement at the Victorian Department of Premier and Cabinet. So I'm delighted to be here as part of the Victorian Government's partnership with the Lowy Institute in 2017. The partnership explores targeted opportunities for cooperation with Southeast Asia through our dedicated Victorian ASEAN Fellow, Matthew Bush, a series of research papers on Southeast Asia, and joint public events like this evening. So on behalf of the Victorian Government, I'd like to thank Professor Rossa and Dr. Setiwan and Matthew for deepening our understanding of Indonesia's education sector. I was reflecting that I think after tonight, I now know more about the forces that drive Indonesia's education sector than I do about the forces that drive Victoria's education system. So I think that's an incredible reflection on the standard of the discussion and the standard of the research and the insights of the people on the panel tonight. It also drove me to reflect on, in thinking about the opportunities for collaboration between Victoria and Indonesia, and indeed Australia and Indonesia, in the education space, that collaboration needs to be considered and thoughtful, as it does sound like it's a very complex system and complex space where opportunities need to be finely thought through. it's great to see such a audience tonight and high-level engagement in terms of the questions that were asked. I'd like to thank each and all of you for coming tonight and for asking such interesting questions and informing the conversation in this space. So tonight's event, after tonight's event, you'll all get notifications sometime in the future about to read Professor Ross's paper, Beyond Access, Making Indonesia's Education System Work. So I encourage you all to read that, and I'll be looking forward to reading that as well. Lastly, I'd just like to finish with a few comments around Victoria's commitment to international engagement, and particular in relation to Indonesia. Broadly, the Victorian government recognises that international connections are essential to Victoria's community and economy. They drive job creation and productivity growth and bring new ideas and innovations to our state. Victoria has an active international agenda and has worked with key international partners over several decades to develop genuine relationships. This international engagement is built on the following pillars: investment in enduring relationships, an emphasis on people-to-people links, a commitment to enhancing Victoria's global and regional capabilities, an extensive overseas network with 21 Victorian government business offices, including one in Indonesia, and strategic official travel to promote government and industry priorities, including the Governor's trip to Singapore and Indonesia in May. In relation to Indonesia, it's a long-valued partner of Victoria. We share strong community connections and established economic links. Education is, of course, a key pillar of this partnership, as all of you know. It's Victoria's second largest export to Indonesia, with 5,400 students currently enrolled in our world-leading institutions. And just last week, which was a fantastic opportunity in Victoria, the newly appointed Indonesian ambassador to Australia made his first official visit to Melbourne, and it was a fantastic visit. And Jordan and our team in DPC organised that visit, and it was fantastic. It showcased Victoria's higher education, vocational education and training, and research capabilities, and underlines the importance of the sector. So in closing, I'd just like to thank the panel members again for the fantastic discussion, and thank you all for coming along tonight.